So I think the first thing I will say is I'm not going to try and cure your computer-related ills today, though we will cover a certain amount, because you've all got different computers, you all use different systems, and they all work slightly differently. So to try and say, press this button and it'll work that way, isn't really practical in a session like this. I often say that learning to use a computer, that's to say that, you know, the physical thing you're touching, should be treated very much like learning to drive. I think you need half hour or 40 minute bursts with someone who knows what they're doing, then you need to go away and practice for a bit and then have another go. So whilst I'll answer all questions I can, please don't say, what happens if I press this button, because it may not be the same for everyone, almost certainly won't be. But the internet is the same for everyone, that's one of its points, so that's really what we're going to focus on today. And I think the first thing I need to say, because I suspect a lot of you feel slightly overwhelmed by the internet, the first thing I'm going to say, Webster's first rule of the internet, actually I've got quite a lot of first rules of the internet, they're all first equal. My favourite one actually is, what can go wrong will go wrong. And one of the things, if you've ever done any presenting of this nature, one of the basic rules they will tell you is never ever have anything to do with technology because it'll go wrong. Never have water anywhere near it. And always be kind to your guests. So we'll try to do the three, get the third one right at least. Anyway, this is really what I want you to understand. Don't panic. If you are remotely concerned about the internet, don't worry about it. Let me remind you that the internet is a great deal younger than any of us here. It began technically, well, there was a sort of internet in the 1980s, but not available to the world. It's the American Defense Organization used. And it was really when Tim Berners-Lee, you may have heard of, in the 1990s, invented something called the hypertext markup language and internet and various other protocols, the key to which was it meant that your computer could talk to another computer in a way that you would understand. And without that bit of brilliance, the internet would never have grown the way it was. The internet, as I say, it began in the 1990s. I was still working in the city in a bank in 1997, when I stopped working in the city. In 1997, that bank, which is a medium-sized merchant bank, it's much bigger now than I've left, I hope that you are connected, didn't have a website. We didn't use email. We were a department of about a dozen, I suppose, and there were two computers in the office, and they were sitting in front of secretaries who used them for typing out letters. That was it. Now, it's fair to say at that point we were a little bit behind the curve, and our solicitors were beginning to say, surely you can email that to me. They just started to say that. And of course, when I left and set up on my own, it became very obvious in 1997, it became very obvious very quickly indeed that if I wasn't on the internet and able to do email and all the rest of it, then I was going to get nowhere, particularly as I was trying to set up a business in Suffolk rather than in the city. It took off at that point. These things happen from time to time, don't they? I mean, I'm sure some of you will remember when suddenly it became, faxes became cheap, in about 1980 or thereabouts. Until then, they'd been vast machines which probably only advertising agencies had to send huge images. And then suddenly Sony or somebody invented the cheap fax, which is about that sort of size, and everybody had to have it. And suddenly, in the space of 6 months, every business had a fax. That, of course, is all gone. I was fascinated. I was reading a novel the other day, which I suppose must have been set in about the 1990, and somebody said, I've had this email, I'll fax it to you. So that's how things have changed. These things change all the time. I was just saying to one of you before we started, she was saying her grandchildren were, she was talking to her about the polar explorers and trying to explain to Scott of the Antarctic and all the others. Had no way at all of contacting anyone beyond their immediate group, absolutely no way at all. And her grandchildren struggle to understand this. And of course, their grandchildren will be just as astounded by the antiquated stuff that Grandma talks about from 2018. It's all changing very fast. That actually is a benefit to me, so I've been writing these columns in the Old Ears since the year 2000. There are two reasons it's lasted so long. One is the Old Ears is an extraordinarily loyal employer, for which I'm enormously grateful. I've never worked for anybody for as long as the Old Ears. And the other is, it's a moving target. There's always something new to write about. And when that stops happening, I suspect it's because something else would have taken over and replaced the internet. Goodness knows what. But then, who knew the internet was going to come 30 years ago? The internet is a teenager. It's younger even than Annabelle. Like a teenager, it's got all the weaknesses and failings of teenagers. It's got angst, unreliability, difficult behaviour, all the stuff you're used to with teenagers. But it also has, just like teenagers, all the hope and promise of teenagers. But it is just a teenager. And we're all older than that, there's absolutely no doubt about it. But it is growing up and changing fast. And that brings loneliness. And one of the things we've seen very often is people trying to do too much on the internet too quickly and making it very difficult. But it is just a teenager. But you all remember the line which attributed to Mark Twain, some people dispute that. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old man around. When I got to be 21, I was astonished how much he'd learned in 7 years. Keep that in mind. The internet is our servant, it's not our master. And really, we've come a long way. How far have we come? Well, I would say that computers at the moment and the internet use... the internet's one thing, I'll explain what the internet is in a minute. But computers are still, whatever you may think, very underdeveloped. They are under-engineered, in my view, and that's inevitable because they're quite new. I'll give you an example. That is a picture of an IBM hard drive being loaded onto an aeroplane in 1956. That will hold 3.75 megabytes of data. My phone contains 26 times as much as that thing does. And my phone isn't even one of the best ones. So that's how far we've come. So I think it's worth bearing in mind that computers are, in my opinion, pretty much like cars might have been in the 1950s. If you remember what cars were like then, they broke down a lot, they were expensive, they were something for the wealthy. You tend to, if it did break down, you had to get someone to mend them, you couldn't really do it yourself, or very few people did. Big companies that owned fleets of cars, employed chauffeurs and mechanics. Nowadays, of course, we can all get into each other's car and drive to Aberdeen and back without very little difficulty. So if you compare the two, you see that the computers, I'm convinced, will eventually develop to have a steering wheel and three pedals or the computer equivalent. So that's where we stand, as it were, at the moment. So if I may, let's start with some absolute basics. And I apologise if I'm teaching Granny to suck eggs here, but I'd like to make sure that we all understand the principles of what's going on. What is the internet? Every computer, when it is connected to the internet, it is on the internet. The internet itself doesn't exist. It's not a thing. It is simply the fact that all these computers are linked to each other. And the way that you experience it and what you see is, this is your laptop down here, or whatever it is you use. That goes up into the cloud, we'll talk about that later, and from there connects to another computer. It might be a social media site, Facebook, it might be an e-commerce site, Amazon, or it might be a media service, BBC iPlayer, that sort of thing, or just any other website. But the key is that the website you're looking at lives in one of these computers, connects to your computer at your request through this interconnecting network of computers. And that's, it's a hard thing to imagine, but that network is growing and growing and growing all the time. And as long as your computer is connected through your ISP, BT, TalkTalk, whoever it may be, to it, you are part of the internet. Within that cloud, there are huge other computers acting as gateways, as crossroads, as guides, but it all works the same way. You, from this computer, send a message out there saying, I want to look at theoldie.co.uk. And something magical happens in here, please don't ask me to explain. And it connects up to the right one of the millions of other computers out here in which the oldest computer data is held. That computer then sends it back down here to you, so you can see it on your computer. Sorry?
Sorry, is it radio? How does it connect?
Wires, one way or another. There is a certain amount of radio, but generally it's all wires or fiber optic cables. Your computer connects to your ISP through the telephone line, I bet.
It does.
And there, they will have other similar lines which connect to other computers.
What about the Wi-Fi?
The Wi-Fi, that's just in your house. that connects your computer to the thing called the router, which is what connects to your ISP. Wi-Fi is a, yes, don't be confused by that. It irritates me beyond words when I hear on the radio people talking complete nonsense, it wasn't that better. And someone was complaining about the Wi-Fi in the countryside being very bad. There is no Wi-Fi in the countryside or anywhere else. The Wi-Fi you can get in this building is something which the Royal Geographic Society have arranged to connect to their version of the little router, the thing with the aerials perhaps, which you have in your house, which then ties into where the internet, the cloud, the black cloud in the middle. That's what it is. So there is no general Wi-Fi. Though it has to be said, there are people who dream that there will be one day. Maybe there will be. But if you just, to give you an idea of how this has affected the world, 12 years ago, I checked this, the five largest companies in the world, measured by market capitalization, were GE, an American manufacturing company. There were a couple of oil companies, I think it was Total and one other, Exxon perhaps, doesn't matter. Citibank, one of the big American bank, and Microsoft, who got in early, because their trick was to sell you software which you couldn't make your computer work without. So those are the five biggest companies in the world by the market capitalization 12 years ago, just 12 years ago. And now, the top five are Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple. It's quite extraordinary how that's changed. And it's not that they're speculative valuations, though many would argue that. These are companies generating enormous amounts of money. There are other companies you've heard of, like Twitter and one or two others, who are hugely, Spotify has just been in the press recently, the music service, hugely valuable companies in terms of market capitalization, but make no money. So let's discount them completely, because the value which the market is describing to them is entirely speculative. But the companies I've just mentioned are generating gigantic amounts of actual cash. They're real companies in that sense. So, here we are, this is, as it were, the internet. You will look at the internet a number of different ways. Obviously something like an iPad or a tablet, a desktop or possibly a laptop, or your phone. Now, within those, there are, particularly on the desktop, you will have what's called a browser. Now, does anyone not know what a browser is? Well, when you switch your computer on and you go to a website, the thing that you're writing the website address in is a bit of software called a browser. If you've done nothing to your computer and it's a Microsoft computer, the chances are it's something called Internet Explorer. Does that ring a bell? So that's the magic bit of software within your computer which allows you to investigate what's in the internet and bring pictures of it back. And that shows you what it is, and that's critical. That's one way of doing it. That's just one way of connecting on this route here. The other way you will have heard of things called apps, which, may I ask, how many, I've forgotten, I did ask you in the survey, how many of you use tablets and phones to look at the internet? Quite a lot. You will have on your phones, there'll be a little thing, press the tab, and it connects you straight to whatever it is you're looking for, whether it's the weather forecast or something else. But those little things, they're little bits of software, and they completely bypass this browser, which I described, which is where you put www.gildy.co.uk, and go straight to it, so you're establishing a link with that website. Now, you don't really need to fully understand it, I'm just explaining that it has changed in the last 10 years. When we started doing this, browsers were the only way. It's now got a good deal simpler through apps, if that's what you use, on a phone and on a tablet. Now, it's the key thing I need you to understand when we come on to talking about security is that, as you can see from this, when you ask, can I look at the Audi website, tick, 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 goes up to wherever the Audi are keeping their, the computer they're keeping their website. I'll show you my website in a minute. And that is, as it happens, housed in New York, because that's the company I pay to keep it on the internet. Doesn't matter where it could be anywhere. There are various legal and political reasons why you might want it somewhere else, but technically it could be anywhere in the world. So wherever the system is, whichever computer in the world it is that's holding the only website, it sends it back here. Now, the key thing there is, as you can see, you've established a direct connection with the Audley website. Now, when the BBC radio programme goes out, and the Today programme goes out in the morning, they haven't got a clue how many people are listening. It goes to the broadcast dialogue aerials, and in the broadcast sense, any number of radios can listen to that if they're in range of the signal. Absolutely any number. Millions and millions and millions. It doesn't make any difference. The BBC has no idea how many people are actually listening. The figures which they tell you are based on opinion polls, ones made of about 1,000 people or 1,500 people, who they do keep a close tab on what they're listening. These people are meant to be representative of us all, and from that they extrapolate how many people are actually listening. I think the numbers are pretty pointless, to be honest, in my view, but and don't achieve very much. I suppose what they might show is trends, but there's probably not much doubt about that. Now, for want of a better phrase, the internet is narrowcasting. I'm not sure what's the right phrase, but it seems to be the opposite of broadcasting. And so when you look at the Audley site, the people who run the Audley site can tell precisely how many people are listening, because it's there is a direct connection between your computer and there and back again. So they can see another person's clicked on. The key to that is that explains why occasionally websites fall over, as they say, because too many people are trying to connect it at the same time. For example, when, I know this happens every year, when the promise tickets go on sale, some of the website falls over, and every year they promise it's not going to, and every year it does. But that's because just too many people connect. This computer here is only set up to handle as many people as they think it needs, and if more people come, it either just grinds to a halt or falls over and shuts down completely. They're getting very clever about this sort of thing, and they can very quickly build up the capacity, particularly if they are using one of the centralised organisations to do this. But let's go back and let me show you. This is another reason why we don't do this, the internet. If I can show you my website, and I'll show you how precise this can be, because nobody looks at my website. So the numbers are nice and small. That's my website, live as it is this moment. Now because I own it, I can log in through the secret login point. Website, you see up here, already, I'm now, in the dashboard of the thing, and I can now start changing things, adding things. But what we want to do now is website management. Don't take this too seriously, they're all different the way they're, but let's have a look at traffic. Now this tells me how many people have looked at the website in the last month. And you can see the spikes. See that point there, that's March 28th, and the Audley was issued in March 28th. The last edition of the Audley came out on March 28th. So, and you see there's not very many, I'm afraid. 52 people looked at it on that day, the actual numbers, that's there. Now, this is not an important website, as you can see. The website itself exists for no reason really other than as a record of what I've written. But I can go into more detail than that. I can tell you what browsers they were using. Safari, that's the one that Macs use. I can Chrome, that's a browser like Internet Explorer, which Google published. Firefox is another browser. We don't know, Unknown 5, Edge is another one, Internet Explorer 9, various others. And I can tell you which operating system they're using, whether you're a Mac, Windows 10, Windows 7, whether it's Android, iPhone you're looking at. Now, I can't tell who you are, and I can't tell which of those numbers is attributed to those, but in general terms, I can see that most people who look at my website, 40% there, are using a Mac, and 27% are using Windows 10. So you see how precise it is, and if I cared to pay for more, a bigger service, I could get even more detail like that. So that gives
you... that sort of thing cost? Use it as a service?
Well, that costs me, I think it's about £12 a month to have. But if lots and lots of people wanted to look at the website simultaneously, I'd have to pay more, because the website, the people in New York would have to provide more. Actually, there's quite a good story attached to them. They're called Squarespace, and they were set up by two chaps almost the same time I started writing for the Audley. And they had a terrible, terrible time a few years ago. I've forgotten the name of it. Can you remember the name of the hurricane that hit New York? Doesn't matter. And there was a huge tidal surge as a result of a hurricane. and it swept across New York, and all the cellars of a lot of the buildings in the financial district where this outfit happens to be renting office space flooded. And that meant that the backup generators were all flooded and were absolutely useless. And the generators on the 17th floor, where it was the Squarespace for living, were keeping their servers, as they're called, their big computers, where my website is living, that's where it sits at the moment. That was going to go for a while, but that was going to run out of fuel. And there were no lifts, and it was 17 floors up. So, they had two alternatives. Either they had to get fuel or power up to the 17th floor, or they had to switch the system off, in which case, literally by then, millions of websites would just go dark. They'd disappear, because they would no longer be on the internet until they got power back and could switch their computers back on again. It's that mortal, as it were. It cheers me up that the internet's not really in control of us, it's quite the other way around. We can't switch these things off. So they organised, the Squarespace, as you can imagine, is staffed by a lot of people with large brains who are not used to manual labour. And they pulled them all in, and their husbands and wives, and they bought, buying fuel wasn't a problem, getting it up 17 floors was. So they had a human chain going up 17 floors on this thing, off buckets of fuel going up, and they kept it going quite breathtakingly, I think, for about 3 days. It's quite extraordinary. By which time they were panicking because the generator on the 17th floor was due to be shut down anyway for servicing. So they thought it was going to die. But by then they'd managed to get a generator on a truck which ran cable up the stairs to keep it going. But that shows you how important it is. These servers, where, as they're called, these computers where the websites live, are actually holding their own and staying alive. So there we have, that's my website. You can see all the detail which I can get there. I can go even more detail. I can get it on hourly, believe it or not. That's today. That's how many people have looked at it today. That's mostly me, I think. Yeah, three people at 8 o'clock, that was me. And 2 hours. And then at 9 o'clock, nobody. Absolutely not. Now, clearly, this is if you had the same figures for a popular website, they'd be in hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands or even millions. But you get the picture. Now, I think probably what you're realizing there is that I can tell quite a lot about the people that are looking at my website. I can tell without knowing who they are or anything particular personal about them, I can tell what time they like to look at it. I can tell the sort of machinery they're using to look at it at, and I think I can tell what countries they're from. I can't offhand see where that is at the moment, but anyway, let's assume I can. And that enables me, if I was using this as a marketing site, to make some decisions about what I put on it, when I do it, when I get in touch with them. Now that leads us on generally to the importance of this direct connection as far as marketing is concerned. Has everyone here used Amazon? Who hasn't used Amazon to buy something? Not many of you. Yes, well. If you had used Amazon, imagine you are Amazon, which is a huge shop and works in two ways. They have a certain amount of stuff which they own stock for, but most of what they do is they are selling stuff on behalf of other people. And so they are, as it were, a broker, a thing broker. If you want to buy a book or a piece of computer equipment or a washing machine or whatever it is from Amazon, odds are they will route you through to a merchant who will send it to you under the rules and regs that Amazon established with them. But Amazon will know who you are because you've told them, you've bought something. And they will know a little bit about you. They will know your address because you want the stuff sent to you. They will know your email address, obviously, because they want 3 million. They will know where you are, they know your name. They will know your, probably know your gender. I forgot whether you have to put that in when you sign up. They may know your age, I can't remember, and so on. And they certainly know what you like to buy. They know what bank your credit cards with, and there's a lot of other stuff, which you can imagine. And so they can begin to build up a picture of the sort of person you might be. Now this is the key to all digital online marketing of this case. They see, right, here's a person who buys a washing machine, and we know they are male, live in Suffolk, have been with us for 20 years, whatever it may be, use this sort of computer, and so on and so on. So they can think, well, what else do we know that people like that on our system have bought? Ah, they've also bought brogues. So next time he comes up, we might put up an advert for some brogues, someone's selling, because I might be interested. And this is the key to all to computer advertising, is this ability to accurately target self as closely as you can to what the person wants to buy, someone who might want to buy things. Much the same is true of Google. If you search anything on Google...
Can I ask what cookies are? You know, sometimes a message comes up, we use cookies.
Oh, wait, well, cookies are how they remember your password, or how they remember a bit about you. They say, you've told us this is your credit card number and so on. It's highly secure, but it makes it very easy when you click onto a website like Amazon. They say, oh, hello again, yes, we know a bit about you because of this tiny little bit of information which we've placed on your computer. It's benign, generally. There are ways of getting rid of it if you don't like the sound of it. But it generally works to your benefit because it makes it easier for them. It saves time when you're dealing with a site like Amazon. It's Google. If we look at Google, now let's take brogues as an example. I search for brogues. Oh, look what happens here. I've searched for brogues, and I know that there are lots of sites I can look at, but guess what? There are some adverts for people selling brogues. Now they know, because I've been on Google before, I've logged in to Google, they know the sort of person I am, so they think those are the sort of brogues I might want to buy. It's a very complicated, desperately mathematical system happening at Google, but that's what's going on, and you'll see that coming up. Now you can ignore these, absolutely, it doesn't matter. Just go down and choose the connection you want to go to there, but it doesn't matter. Remember that the key thing about internet services is if they are free, you are the product. This is very often said. They're not free, really. You're buying the service they provide by giving them data about yourself. That's how it works. That's why they make, how they can make money, so then they can advertise, place appropriate advertising to you. I mean, when you consider what they know about you, they know an awful lot. Google know an awful lot about me, because I've been using it for years, and they've seen the sites I go to. They know how long I spend on each site. They know how long I hover over. As I do this, I think about clicking on that, and I decide not to. I think about clicking on that, I decide not to. That's all being recorded, and will be built into what they provide next time. It may be next time I look, the one I didn't click on won't appear. Because, and that's not sinister, it's just that the advertiser is saying, I don't want to appear on the page of someone who's thought about clicking on me and didn't. I'm not going to pay for that. So Google are able to say, fine, we'll do it that way then. We'll send your ads to someone else who might do better.
If you've got Google Mail or Gmail,
yes.
Can you link that information?
Oh yes, absolutely. Google themselves, and I'm actually rather a fan of Google. I think in general terms, so far, they're benign. I don't quite feel the same about Facebook at all. But in general terms, Google are benign. There's a lot of services they provide for nothing in return for the data they collect from us all. Internet marketing is a numbers game. If you've got millions and millions and millions of people, you can find people that will fit the profile that the advertisers particularly want. Now, when we move over to Facebook, may I ask how many of you used seen Facebook?
Not many,
yes. Well, I'm not surprised. Well, I'm slightly surprised in one sense, because Facebook, you've heard of this, and what it is, it's like a personal website. So it tells me that's me, Matthew. It's a personal website, and two things are happening. If I chose to, can post something there, which would appear. I would say, I'm doing the Oldie course this morning. It will go on there, and anybody who can find my profile, and they're not secret, can say, oh, I see Matthew's doing the Oldie course today. And a lot of people place an enormous amount of very personal information on here, most of the time without realizing it. And if you don't use it, you need to worry about it, but I think you probably ought to be aware of it, because it's been in the news a lot just recently, as you all know. The owner, Mark Zuckerberg, was being done in front of the Senate committee, I think it was, in America yesterday, for wearing a suit for the first time in his life, it was said. and looking very uncomfortable, which I might add. But he was able to deal with it all very well, and he's not a salesman. He's a man who prefers sitting in front of a computer to talking to people, mainly because the people interviewing him haven't got a clue what was going on. There was a great moment when one of the elderly and extremely respected senators said to him, but Mr. Zuckerberg, if you don't charge anybody for this, how on earth do you make any money? He said, but we've got adverts all over the site. That's how we make gigantic amounts of money. Now, if you are a user of Facebook, and I've used it for years, Facebook know an enormous amount about you. They know all the stuff that you probably told them when you set up your account, your name, your age, your address probably, whatever it is they ask, the basic stuff. And then they know your behavior. And they know, oh look, he's keen on the Hanging Stars, which is a group I like. Or I look at the New York Times. I've clicked on that, I've gone to look at whatever it is the New York Times are saying there. All that goes into the Facebook. It also knows how long I have gone like that and not clicked. I have goes how long I've gone like that and not clicked, or looked at that, or at a more basic level, I can like this, as they call it, and so that just emphasizes that I'm really keen on it. I can add a comment, do that, and I write a comment, and I'll put okay, just like that.
So even if you're not clicking,
it's
still registered.
Oh yes, the movement of the mouse, it knows what you're looking, knows what you're doing.
Does that mean that everyone else who's on Facebook knows that as well?
No, not at all. It's only within Facebook itself. And you shouldn't be too alarmed by it, because the chances of anybody delving deep enough in personally to find out what you personally do, very remote. These are all generalizations which they use to sell advertising. Because then what happens is, somebody places an advert on the Facebook site and somebody buys it. And it may be, might be a man in the 60s with a lot of experience in the internet. Or whatever it is that my profile tells me. So the advertiser then goes to Facebook and says, this chap bought whatever it argues me, whatever it is worth selling. He bought it. I want to place my advert on pages of similar people. So Facebook will go into it. Literally billions of users worldwide, and say, here are 1,000, 100,000, a million people who very closely fit the profile of the person who has just bought whatever it is you're selling. So I will say, okay, well, I can only afford 1,000 adverts, place my advert 1,000 times on the 1,000 people you think are most closely related to the profile I have. So odds are, if that works, then I will sell more. They can also say, hold on a minute, you're selling this particular gadget. We know somebody else who sells something very similar. They found that the people under 25 like it as well as people in their 60s. This has been very successful here. So I can say, okay, take my 1,000 adverts on PayPal, put half of them in the under 25 group you're talking about, half of them I've already established, and we'll see which works best. So you see how important this direct link is, because the Facebook can say, right, I need another man in his 60s who needs a pair of brogues, whatever it is, who fits the same profile as Matthew, and those adverts will appear only on pages seen by that chap. And from there, that may not work, in which case you refine the situation and so on and so on. But it's always been the holy grail of all the advertising industry that they can find direct their adverts precisely as possible to the people who are likely to buy, and this is not new after all. Now, I suppose the question we need to ask is, do we mind about this? Do you look at
different adverts?
No, well that's fine, in which case you won't be showing the ones which you can look at. Well, sooner or later, you may look at one, or show some interest in it, whether by hovering your mouse over it or something like that, in which case that may come up again. Or you may buy something at a site where you said, okay, I do like this particular sort of book, or whatever it is. If you think about it, advertising to specific demographic groups is nothing new. Advertisers used to choose which newspaper to put their ad in because the sort of people they knew would bought by a paper. You all know the old joke about the people that run the country by the Times, the people that own the country by the Financial Times. It's rather out of date now, isn't it? The people would like the country to run away. It was 20 years ago by the Daily Telegraph. People about the Express think it is run away. It was run 20 years ago. And so on down the line to the people who read The Sun. You don't care who's running your country as long as she's good in a swimsuit. But the advertisers have for years been trying to save money on advertising by only advertising to the people who are likely to buy. The egregious Alan Sugar, sorry if you're referring to Alan Sugar, makes a very good point. He said he spent millions and millions of pounds on advertising, 75% of which is completely wasted, but he doesn't know what is 75%. I've sympathised with it. That's the way it works. Now, using Facebook or Google or placing adverts through there, in theory, and certainly in terms, it seems to be working in terms of setting adverts, you could be much more precisely targeted. It cuts both ways, in the sense that, in theory, the more you use it, the less likely you are to see an advert for something which you simply aren't interested in. Also, you're likely to see an advert for something which has never occurred to you that you're interested in, but they know that other people like you are interested in. So it cuts in all directions, and it, as I say, I'm not sure that I really mind, particularly Google, knowing all the stuff about me, provided I'm getting a service I value in return. And I do. I get free email from them. Many of you kindly filled in a form which tells me a little bit about your experience with the internet before you came here. That's a free service provided by Google. We're coming on later to Google Photographs, and we can store your photos and so on. And there's an awful lot which they do provide. And the reason they do that is to keep me interested in using Google so that they can carry on selling adverts and making a huge profit as a consequence.
Matthew, can I just
answer
that Facebook? The reason I don't on Facebook is I don't want people to know what I'm doing. I was furious in 2009 that my wife and I went on holiday, and I didn't want people to know we were on holiday. I got back, and a woman in my office said, "Oh, I saw a picture of you and Margaret on the beach in this paper."
Right.
And I only been clicking that somebody took a photograph of a friend of my son who was lived there, took a photograph of us on the beach.
Facebook.
And that must have been. So, how did that work?
Well, did you put your email in there?
It wasn't a son, it was this little girl that did. So, she must have shared that with somebody.
She would have put it on her Facebook page. She may have mentioned your name. Or your family's name may be connected with, but there will have been an identifiable link between the person who took the photograph and the person in your office, with whom you are friends on Facebook, I imagine.
Well, I'm not on Facebook at all. You see, that's why I
do. Oh, well, okay. Well, in that case, they are friends. The person in your office is a friend of a friend of a friend, perhaps, of this person who took the picture. And something we'll come on to later about, you know, privacy is. One of the things which is disappearing fast is privacy. We need to think about it a bit.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that happened to us which is similar is I googled our address and discovered that someone had put fences up in our back garden and taken a picture. And because the picture had the location in its background data, that came up on the search.
Someone put fences in your back garden you haven't noticed?
No. I employed them to do that.
Oh, I see.
On their website.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's naughty.
No, I think it's not
official,
but I then found it because they didn't actually say where it was.
It
was
in
the background data
for
that picture.
People haven't really thought about this, but you're absolutely right. They, like anything else, they should have asked your permission to put that up there. You may have known it, it may be fine, as far as you can say. Or you may not want to defend it, that's fine. By putting your picture on the brochure, satisfied customer, you'd think that most people would ask before you do that. And we're going to come on to this new thing called the General Data Protection Regulation. We'll come on to it a bit later, which is intended to tighten up a lot on this, and I hope people make people a lot more aware of how irritating it is, and in fact, potentially how dangerous it might be. I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes, though, speaking about the recent Cambridge Analytica fuss, which you will have read about, even if you didn't fully understand it, and very few people do. I'll just explain what they did. Hang on a second. Cambridge Analytica did two things, neither of which was illegal, and neither of which breached the terms and conditions of Facebook, though that's probably going to change. First of all, they put up on their own page a survey asking people about their personal life. And they ask a few basic questions, age, where do you live, paper do you read, that sort of thing. Little bits from which they could build up a picture of who you were. And by taking part in that survey, without realising it, though you had ticked a box at some point in the past, they could then see who you were, who your friends are, who they're connected to, who they're connected to, and build up, consequently, an enormous amount of data. Not something you can do as a person, but a computer can do this in a flash. They did that, and that built up a lot of data about millions of people, with whom they were then able to, in theory, tell politicians or whoever was interested, if you want to place adverts for people who have met this profile, say, vote for me, bang, there you are, there are the people, do it that way. The second thing they did, which is a bit murkier, is something called screen scraping. That page there, we can all see it, it's not closed off, anyone can look at that, it's the New York Times. You can, if you've got the right technology, get a machine to just read, literally read that, and extract numbers just as you might write it down in a notebook. Exactly the same way. You're not technically taking any data out of Facebook's computer and putting it in yours, you're actually reading it and retranscribing it into your computer. But all the data is the same. That's called screen scraping, for obvious reasons. You're sort of scraping the information off the screen without necessarily Facebook being aware that's going on. Now, I have some sympathy for Facebook here because, though not much, it's because it's actually very, very difficult to prevent that happening. If the site's open to the world, it's open to the world. You can't stop people looking at it. They're taking steps technologically to try and prevent that happening, but you can be quite sure the people who do it are going one step ahead and will carry on doing it.
They don't. People click on your contacts and find out about those people.
It depends how you set it up. If you've got a list of friends, there are privacy settings you can change. They're a bit hidden. They're not easy to find. They're not very clear, in my view. And that's something which Facebook are going to have to change a lot. It seems to me. But if you're scraping, is not necessarily a bad thing, in the sense that if you go to a price comparison site, for example, there's a very good one if you ever buy airplanes called Skyscanner. And what that does, say I want to fly from Stansted to Rome, it will look at every airline it knows flies that route website very quickly, and it'll read them all. Some of them will have a direct connection with it, negotiate a direct connection, but in many cases it'll just read them all and say, the cheapest flight is, whatever it is, Alitalia or somebody from this flight, this is the flight on this day at the moment, click here, we'll take you to the site, you can buy the flight, you do that, Skyscanner gets a tiny commission from Alitalia. That's the way that works. And that screen scraping would work to your benefit. They're looking at other people's websites for you. You could look at all the websites yourself and come to the same conclusion. Much quicker just to go to one site and have somebody else do it for you. Security sites are very often similar. Statistics, I mean, for example, the Land Registry make all their information available to the public. It's public information. It used to be you had to go to the Land Registry and plough through all bits of paper to see what's publicly available. Most of it is now available online. One way of making use of that is through screen scraping, which they don't mind because it's publicly available information. It's in the public domain.
Can I just ask a question? A follow-up on contact. You've got a contact. On your iPhone or wherever. Is that easily available or do you actually have to set privacy settings to stop?
That's a bit like asking how long a piece of string is, I'm afraid. It depends on where you're keeping in what context you're keeping the contact list. My contacts are all, I'm afraid I use Google completely. My list of everybody I've ever been in touch with, it seems to me, in the last 20 years is in Google. Therefore, it's transmitted to this, so I can get in touch through that if I want to, or that. In theory, that is very secure, and it's not generally available unless I choose to make it so. And the default setting is high security. There may be a good reason why you want to share it, in which case you could say to your friends, here is a list of 20 people coming to the party, or something like that. But generally speaking, you're safe unless you have told them it's okay. And in Facebook, that's a very grey area. In Google, Gmail, most of the email settings, don't worry about it. But in Facebook, it's a very grey area because the whole point of Facebook is to connect people around the world. Zuckerberg, the managing director, has this sort of dreaming of, dreamy view of let's do away with privacy, everybody needs to be connected, that'll make the new world wonderful. Now, I don't call me old-fashioned, no man. I just don't think that's the case, and increasingly people are getting more and more fed up with the idea that somebody else does know what's going on. My son, who we're going to hope it works, we're going to see on the screen shortly, so in the second session, works in this industry. He does internet marketing for musicians, mainly. And he tells me that nobody under 25 uses Facebook anyway anymore. It's increasingly an older person's thing. There are grey areas with what's available, and this is something which I don't know quite where we go to. Company's house information, for example, is all public. And I bet you there's a few people in here who've been a director of a company at some point or other. I certainly have. You can find out stuff about me at Company's House because it's in the public domain. It's meant to be. That's the whole point. And there are companies which make it, Company's House themselves make it very easy. We'll have a look later. But other companies make it even easier because the information is there, it's open, it's available. If you are remotely connected to anybody who's been in the public eye at any point, almost certainly someone will have written something about it somewhere. If your grandfather was an MP, perhaps, or if you're discovered the Tutankhamun tombs, or whatever, or even just remotely well connected, chances are there'll be something there. My oldest son has discovered that if you've got anybody seriously titled in your family, which my wife has, I certainly haven't, going back a bit, whilst the records are very good, he's managed to trace his own ancestry back down to someone called Pedro the Cruel in Spain, and two or three mythical Norse gods in Norway and around there. So, but the point is, you will be, if you're remotely connected to anybody, you might be up there. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, because historical information is historical information. So-and-so was an MP, so-and-so was a director of this company. It's not a fact you can deny. It's not something necessarily that can be hidden. So how easily, the fact is now much more easily available, that's the difficulty that we face, and I don't really know what the answer is. I had a charming experience, but he didn't think it was. 3 or 4 years ago, I live in a Suffolk village, and we were at a village event, and I was chatting about this to an elderly gentleman, even older than I am, in the village, and he was saying, well, I don't have to worry about the internet because I'm not on it. And I said, well, are you sure about that? He said, absolutely, I won't have it in the house, and I'm not on it. I said, well, just a moment, let me just show you. Tap. And I was able to tell him he'd been a trustee of this charity, which regiment he'd been to, which school he'd been to, and a couple other things like that. And he was absolutely appalled. He said, show me, I'd love to show you. Oh, delete that immediately, please. I said, well, that's not how it works. This is somebody else's site I'm looking at. I'm using my phone, as it were, a telescope, to look into that person's site and see what's there. And if you want to get them to remove it, then you need to get in touch with them. And people have been having more and more careful about this. When the internet first started, there were many of them were terribly keen on just publishing a whole list of who was there, their addresses, their telephone numbers. Very quickly discovered that this was very unpopular with a lot of people because they got all sorts of marketing stuff sent to them, if nothing else. Even the Diocese of Bury St Edmunds in Ipswich. I'm secretary of the parochial church council in our village, and without asking me or any of the other people in that position, they posted all our names, addresses, telephone numbers, emails on the website, and these are the people in touch with if you're interested. And you won't be surprised to learn that quite a lot of us are rather irritated by this. It's no particular secret that I'm secretary of the PCC, but it's not something, and certainly not my telephone number and email. If you wanted to advertise or send marketing material to upright, upstanding members of the Church of England, one of the first places you might go to do some screen scraping is the Diocese of Bury St Edmunds and Ipswich website to see what you can get out of it. You might end up 200 or 300 prime contenders for what you might do with them, do with that stuff. So it does the electoral roll, for example, that is publicly available. It's not quite as easily available as you might think, and you can opt out of being publicly available. The trouble with that is, it means that when you want to try and prove your identity to someone, if you're opted out, they can't look at it, and so they can't find another way for opening a bank account or something like that. It does, it has pros and cons, but that's there. And there's an outfit running for years called 192.com who have paid for access to the electoral roll, and for a fee they will happily show you who's on the electoral roll in your area, their names, addresses, their ages, or whatever else information they can get. And they will pick up other information from the phone book and elsewhere. And all this is perfectly legal. It's all information we have willingly put out there. So, as I say, the difficulty we find is that we don't quite know where we stand. It's all a bit, it's distinctly murky. GDPR, which I mentioned, the General Data Protection Regulation, which is a new, it's one of the last knockings of what the EU will do to us before we leave. This comes into power next month. And this significantly tightens up the rules and regulations about what you can do with other people's data. I've been to 3 seminars on this for various other reasons, not just because I'm in on these columns I write, and they've all posed more questions than I've asked, answered. But there's absolutely no doubt that things will get a lot tighter, and for appalling breaches of this sort of data, there are enormous fines. TalkTalk, the internet people, were recently fined £400,000 for some sort of a data breach, which I can't remember the details, but it was relatively serious in terms of they let out a lot of details about some of their customers. Under the new regulations, that £400,000 would probably be more like £15 million. They are gigantic possibility of fines, potentially, based largely on turnover. Now, if you imagine a company like Google being charged a fine 2% of its turnover, when it turns over billions and billions and billions of dollars and pounds a year, this is really fierce stuff. And if they can enforce it, it will make a big difference. But I think its main point, and the most important aspect of it, is that it should allow various companies who are looking after your data to take more care of it. I did ask one question of one of the lawyers who was addressing us about this subject and saying, we, as lawyers do, forgive me if you're a lawyer, we won't really know what the law is until it's been tested in court. But basically what they did were able to say that if you're, I said, does this apply to paper records? And they said, yes, it's neatly filed in your filing cabinet. Yes, it does apply. If it's a terrible mess on your desk, no, it doesn't. So I thought, well, I'm all right then. I'm not coming back.
It was just with regard to this, the BBC, for instance, with their iPlayer.
Yeah.
Unless you fill in the form exactly as they want it, with your age and your all your details, you cannot get sight of BBC iPlayer.
Yeah.
Even if you are, they don't ask you for your license number, which surely is the one way.
I couldn't agree with you more. BBC are in a terrible mess about this.
But I find that very, very awful. And I haven't signed in, and I find it ridiculous.
Well, yes, I think the BBC are probably not a very fair example, because actually they're pretty good about this. They don't ask very much. And I've forgotten exactly. They ask your name, which doesn't have to be your name, and an email address, which could be an email address you dispose of.
Yes.
And I've forgotten what else happened, but not much more than that. And the reason
and
they
address and age.
Do they actually ask that?
Yes.
Oh, do they? Well, put something different down. It doesn't matter. Provided you put the same thing down each time, it doesn't matter. But once you're in, the point is that once you've logged in, they will then bring up the programs which you are last watching.
But the whole point of doing that was because of wanting to know that you paid your license.
So I don't think
they asked for the license.
No, I don't think it was the point of doing it at all. I think it was the point was going back to this direct marketing idea. I think, yes, you're right. That's an adjunct orientation. They do ask you, have you got a license? And you say, yes, as everybody does. They have a lot.
They don't ask you though, they use the information to find out if you've got a license.
Yeah. They may do, I don't know.
Definitely not.
You think you're
saying, I occupy various properties and I've got a free, because of my age, I've got a free license on one. But I was getting reminders everywhere to pay a license. So I said, could you tell me which one I've got? One of them must be in effect. We're not allowed to divulge anything about licenses.
Yes.
But they do say it's on their website that they use it to.
Do they?
Yes.
Oh, well, I wouldn't think. I don't
believe
that
all. To be able to check.
They're going to do it. Frankly, I would think it works the other way. If they find someone they think they haven't got one, they might check and see whether you've said you had. But I really don't know, I'm afraid. I just don't believe that
would be nice. This is the same for many things, that you either have to fill in the forms as they want it or else you cannot get access.
Well, that's right. And then, as I say, in return for a free service, you've got to give them something. And if it's a service of great value, don't give them the information. That's the quid pro quo.
But I haven't paid my license, therefore.
Well, I'm not sure why you object to this, though, because you paid your license. You know, they know you exist. They know you've paid your license.
Yes, but
so why are you ashamed of telling them?
Because there's question. That's right, but there are questions in there, such as age.
But that's important because our colleague here is about this. I've forgotten what the age is. 75.
75.
Yes. When it becomes. I'm sorry. I'm not an apologist for these. I just don't. Having already bought a license from them. I don't quite see what the problem is in telling them that it's you that's looking.
It is purely the questioning form of...
If you don't like it, that's fine, as I said, but you've already paid for the license, I don't see why you can't.
I just make a comment. I've not had a television for 45 years,
yes.
And in that time, it was quite interesting. I was visited twice,
yes.
By expected many coders who refused to come in. I said, come in, why the television? And then they wouldn't come in the door. I mean,
you may know a journalist called Charles Moore.
He's been
carrying on this battle for years and years and years. He's got a flat in London with no television. He's been getting letters. He went to court once. I'm sure I'll write a book about it one day. It does. I mean, the BBC, I think, is an odd example because you are buying something from them. At least they've got themselves in a real muddle over this, frankly.
Yes, it's the radio as well.
The radio is free to anyone, whoever they are, without a license. If your son or daughter is at university and is watching the live television on their laptop, but the laptop is not plugged into the wall, they're on your license. As soon as they plug it into the wall, they've got to get their own license. This is the sort of nonsense and muddle they've got themselves into. It's a complete muddle. I can't, personally, it's not really relevant to today, but I can't see the license fees staying as it is at the moment. Fewer and fewer people have televisions. I've got three children, aged 28 upwards. Two of them don't have a television. The third one does, because her husband is very keen on watching football and he likes the big screen. But that's the only reason, and the only television they watch is stuff which is beamed down the internet rather than through the aerial, apart from their football match and so on.
Can I just ask you about, take you back to your son's comment about Facebook, maybe
under 25? It's a rather general comment.
Yes. Is that fashion or security concern?
No, it's competition. Things like Snapchat and Instagram are taking over, the youngsters.
So they're alternatives.
Exactly. But we're not going to deal with that today, I'm happy to say. So, as I say, the main thing I want to stress to you, as I said at the start, don't panic. Most of the information which you give them, apart from stuff which you are deliberately giving out publicly on likes of Facebook, is not personalised. It's true that Google can look into my file, if you like, in their computers and see an awful lot of what I've done and then read all my emails. As can all of your email providers. They can look at the sites I've looked at and all the rest. But that information is not sold to anyone else. Not, as it were, with my name attached anyway. That would be a strict breach of their terms and conditions, and that would be a major, major criminal event in most countries. And when the GDPR rules come in, it'll be even worse and worse. So all I'd say is, whilst it might be slightly alarming, I don't think, provided you're getting a service which you value in return, my view is, let's live and let live. Now, you may think that's a little easygoing. Maybe I should be fiercer. But I think that the next point is that be sensible about what you publish anywhere. And this is particularly the case on Facebook. In the case, Google tried to set up a version of Facebook called Google Plus, which nobody used, so forget about that, because it just didn't take off. But if you are putting stuff about yourself anywhere on the internet, Facebook, we haven't mentioned Twitter is another one where people put reams of stuff. It's an organisation called LinkedIn, you may be aware of, which is a professional connections, which is very respectable in many ways, but people put an enormous amount of personal information on there. And I just think, I mean, there may be a good reason for it. But just be very careful about what you're putting on there. I think it's increasingly we will find that people are upset to discover what is being found out about them. We see this all the time. If in doubt, don't do it. There's a rather alarming little video going around at the moment, published by UNICEF, in which they bring some children into a sort of mock press conference and put them in front of them sitting on a desk. They don't really know what's going to happen, with microphones and lights and cameras, and ask them questions about their basketball playing and their flute playing, and Gabriel's not very happy at the moment. And the children say, well, how do you know all this? Then, because you've put it all on Facebook. It's all there. It's you know, anyone can see this. Or it may not be Facebook, it may be Instagram, which we often use, which is very similar thing, or Snapchat and various others. Then UNICEF are trying to encourage children in particular not to be so open about themselves. I think people of our generation generally are more inclined to be private. The gentleman in my village who said he wasn't on the internet and wouldn't have it in the house. And so my own father, my late father, was absolutely furious when he discovered that somebody else had got an email address with his name. Well, it wasn't a very uncommon name, and it wasn't really a surprise, but he wanted to know, who is this person? So if in doubt, don't put anything on the internet. And I think if you don't want it to appear on the front page of the Daily Mail, don't put it there. Don't put it up there.
Well, it's the gathering of the information, isn't it, really? It's what you think of those children.
Yes.
It's that their information is being gathered.
And that's creepy, isn't it?
That's not. That's
it's very unpleasant.
It needs to be queried.
Yeah, I agree. But they put it there.
Yes, if they need that's to live the their open lives, but it shouldn't be gathered.
You know? Well, yes, probably right. But if you've put it in the open, it's in the open. It's like painting your house blue. Everyone can see it's blue.
But when they're talking with their friends and saying odd things, the next day they've forgotten about it.
Yes, I
that
agree.
Is something that should be given.
So they should be doing should that be through given. Various direct messaging systems rather than on a public space. I've said many times, if you put something in a public space, you should be prepared to stand on the Trafalgar Square, the empty pit in Trafalgar Square, with a megaphone, and repeat it. Yeah. And if you're not prepared to do that, you shouldn't put it in a public space.